Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Day, technology is neutral. It's not pro-democracy and it's not pro-authoritarianism. And I think the reality is that as we're developing new technologies, we need to be much, much better at understanding on the front end what the upside elements of those technologies are, what the opportunities are, and then what the downside risks are. There's very clear evidence about the relationship between Huawei, ZTE, and the Chinese government, in particular the security services, as well as, of course, the party. The Trump administration's approach is not a strategy. Parts of what the Trump administration is doing, I think, actually undermine our ability to have a smarter, tougher, more strategic approach to China. I do think that there is potential for even greater bipartisan consensus on what to do about China, but that may not necessarily reflect in any way what the Trump administration is doing.
G'day, welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Catherine Manstead, and this is the podcast that looks at the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. This podcast is brought to you by policyforum.net and the National Security College at the Australian National University. In this episode, we're absolutely privileged to have in the studio Laura Rosenberger, who is the director of the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. She is a former senior career diplomat and national security official and was national security advisor to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Laura Rosenberger, welcome to the National Security Podcast.
Hey, Catherine. Happy to be here.
Now, you've been in Australia now for about 2 weeks. You're a distinguished Vice-Chancellor's distinguished visitor at the ANU, and we've been introducing you to all things Australia and democracy. You've learned about democracy sausages, donkey votes, compulsory voting and crossbenches. I was wondering, from your perspective as an American in Australia, what has struck you as interesting, surprising or unusual about Australian democracy and our approach to national security challenges?
Well, you neglected to list the kangaroo boxing match that you also managed to introduce me to while I was here. And I think while it may not be directly related to the health of democracy, it certainly is an amusing sight. So I wouldn't want to miss including that. But no, it's really been an amazing nearly 2 weeks here, getting to kind of deep dive both on Australian thinking and procedures around democratic resilience. But also, approaches to countering foreign interference. I think two things stick out at me just sort of off the top of my head. One from the list of things that you mentioned, obviously I think compulsory voting is one area that is quite different from the American approach. And I think, different without sort of ascribing positive or negative aspects there. But I think that is certainly one thing that is presents different challenges and opportunities, potentially. We'll think about it that way. I also think, as I think particularly about not only democratic resilience, but countering foreign interference and what that means and the best ways of going about that. One of the things I often have to start off with to U.S. audiences in talking about strategies to counter foreign interference is the need for it to be a bipartisan approach. That's something that in the United States has unfortunately not really characterize how we've been responding to this challenge, and I think it's it's much to our detriment that we are not responding that way. And so here in Australia, I had known already that the response here had really been bipartisan to the foreign interference challenge, but really getting to appreciate that in a lot of great depth through conversations with people from across the political spectrum and from different sectors of government, the private sector, civil society. That's really been an encouraging thing for me because I think it really absolutely is essential to responding effectively to foreign interference.
Well, certainly we do have a long history in Australia of bipartisanship on a lot of foreign policy and national security issues. One thing as a nation we also have a long tradition of is a healthy skepticism for politicians and for democracy as a process. Now, in many respects, that's a good thing and it's part of the Australian culture. But in recent times, we've seen a bit of an alarming collapse in trust in politics in Australia and also trust in the very fact that democracy as a system of government is the best way to take us forward into the future. And I know that that coincides with global trends as well in the survey data and in kind of sliding into a liberalism that we see in countries across the world. How are you thinking about, I mean, you work for the Alliance for Securing Democracy. How are you thinking about the challenges that democracies face in continuing to be relevant and robust into the future?
I think it's a huge challenge. And for me, it comes down to a couple of things. One, I think is, certainly 1989, we're kind of coming up on the 30th anniversary of the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall. There were those who were declaring an end to history and the idea that, democracies could be consolidated and therefore kind of would be self-perpetuating was sort of the thinking du jour. And I think in many ways, the awareness of why democracy matters and the need to continue to, as I think about it, tend the garden of democracy. It doesn't actually take care of itself. Democracy is as much a practice and a set of norms as it is a set of laws or constitutional underpinnings. And so I think that a lot of people around the world kind of fell out of the practice of democracy and stopped thinking or living in many sort of visible ways, in daily practice kind of ways, the very essential core elements of democratic practice. And we thought about democracy just as a system of governments when it's really so much more than that. And so for me, a lot of what we need to do to build democratic resilience, what we need to do to restore faith in democracy is, number one, connect it back to people's lives. Why does democracy matter to people's daily lives? Number two, what are the basic practices of democracy that citizens can engage in? I think people automatically obviously think of voting. Now, again, here in Australia, it's compulsory. And so that's different. Running for office, all these kinds of ways. But, there's many ways to practice small d democracy, whether that's being involved in community organizations, being sitting on local city councils or whatever the case may be. Even little things like some of my neighbors in Washington organizing themselves to get more dog parks. As a dog owner, I certainly think that's an inherent good. But there's a lot of ways to practice democracy. And by the way, as we increasingly spend time online in the social media space where our online communities tend to be segregated into people who agree with us and where we don't have as much contact with people who don't agree with us, or where when we encounter people who don't agree with us, our tendency is to argue rather than listen. And the medium certainly facilitates that. I think building, community spaces again where we can engage with neighbors who may or may not agree with us on big political questions, but simply having some of that connective tissue that allows us to be citizens in a democracy with different views, but understanding that our values may still broadly be the same, is also really important to rebuilding some of that that practice of democracy.
Well, it's interesting, too, you mentioned the period following the Cold War in the 1990s, where in many respects we thought democracy had won the global challenge and that authoritarianism was kind of consigned to the dustbin of history. But the 1990s was also the time when we saw transformational technological change starting, the commercialization of the internet. And it strikes me as at the same time as we thought democracy had kind of won the day, we also thought that these new technologies, in particular the internet, would kind of lead the charge of democracy and another wave of democratization forward, that the internet, that connecting people via the internet would be enough to kind of create those spaces of community that you spoke about, and that having free speech and the transfer of information on the internet would keep our politicians accountable. That was the accepted wisdom back then. Fast forward to today, and there's a lot of fear that those technologies and new emerging technologies don't just not help democracy, but in some ways play into the hands of authoritarians. How should we be thinking about kind of the relationship between democracy and technology from a security perspective?
Yeah, I think we went from thinking about technology as an inherent good. You know, Bill Clinton famously talked about how, you know, the internet going to China and trying to maintain control with it there was sort of like nailing Jell-O to the wall. You can't do it. And his thinking was that once the internet arrived in China, there would be no way for the Chinese Communist Party to continue to exercise the kind of control that it had previously on the information space. And that certainly has been proven false, as China has shown its ability to build the Great Firewall. You know, now what many people even talk about is the Great Canon, as it's you know, starting to build the firewall out, and you know, layering on top of that now, of course, its system of the, you know, social credit enabled by facial recognition and other kinds of surveillance technology. You know, even more recently, of course, we had, you know, the conversations around the Arab Spring, where social media was really seen as a key function, you know, key enabling function for organizing activists. And, you know, I think obviously in the last few years, we've seen much more directly, again, some of the downsides where authoritarian regimes have figured out not only how to push back on those uses of technology, but also how to actually gain the upper hand with them. My own view is that at the end of the day, technology is neutral. It's not sort of pro-democracy and it's not pro-authoritarianism. But I think that we've vacillated between technology as this inherent good and now technology is this, you know, inherent evil. And I think the reality is that as we're developing new technologies, we need to be much, much better at understanding on the front end what the upside elements of those technologies are, what the opportunities are, and then what the downside risks are.
And when you say we in that formulation, I mean, is this something government should lead on? Is it is a citizen movement that we need? Is it indeed something that the private sector needs to be thinking about more? And if so, how, you know, how do we start making those movements so that the private sector is more on the front foot on this stuff?
Well, I think it is broadly a whole of society challenge, but let me break that down in a couple of different ways. So one is, you know, as the creators of technology, I do think that the private sector has a particular role to play here. In fact, probably what I would argue is an obligation to maybe do a little bit more work of, you know, what we would call red teaming or doing risk assessments on a number of different fronts before technologies are new technologies are shipped. There's been this kind of pack and ship mentality in Silicon Valley in particular that's been very focused on moving technology very quickly because change is moving fast and we need to be able to keep up with the pace and number one, outcompete. You know, as in many industries, the short-termism of investors and Wall Street and quarterly earnings reports all feed into this process. But the reality is that the mindset has traditionally been on many of these things that you ship the product and then you figure out what the vulnerabilities and risks are once it's in the wild and you patch them. And the problem now is that we've seen a number of instances where those vulnerabilities are first detected by adversarial or authoritarian nation states who exploit them in ways that are very detrimental to our national security. We're not just talking about a small bug in
in the system, we're talking about, you know, pretty significant implications. And so we've got to be we as in the tech sector has to be better about doing some of that red teaming. But I also think that that requires better connectivity with the national security community, with government. Government's got to be forthcoming with what the risks are, where the threats may be, and ensure that there is that kind of connective tissue. Frankly, we also need policymakers who better understand the technologies that they are talking about and potentially trying to regulate.
And this is the risk in this space, right? Because we know that action needs to be taken, but knee-jerk reactions to kind of technological risks, or indeed risks about how society uses technology, which is even perhaps more of a human or a social problem than a technology problem, risk in some sense overstepping the mark or having very unintended consequences that we necessarily weren't thinking about. So I guess the education piece you're talking about there is important as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is a complicated set of challenges where sometimes the most obvious or easiest solutions are not the best ones. And so certainly when it comes to regulation and legislation, that's not to say that there aren't any things that can be done. I mean, for instance, in the United States, we don't have any framework, any legal framework around data at all. No data protection, no data privacy,
no data
security.
There's a weird patchwork of privacy legislation and some data protection, but not in any kind of universal way, right?
Not in a universal way, not in a way that is actually and the patchwork is largely been built over time for a different era, frankly, that doesn't reflect the kind of data collection that is enabled on modern platforms of today. And certainly if we want to project forward to 5G, nothing that comes to, you know, the kinds of capabilities that we'll see on a 5G network when it comes to data processing, data collection. So I think there are things that can be done and need to be done on the legal and regulatory side. But it's got to be smart and sophisticated, and it can't be, number one, steps that in any way, I think, further undermine trust in our institutions. So back to your point earlier about sort of the erosion of trust, I worry about steps that would actually potentially undermine it may make us feel more secure in the moment, but in the longer term undermine faith in institutions or in information. But that also goes to the sort of third prong of my whole of society answer, which is that I do think that civil society has to play a role here. I mean, number one, we need to strengthen independent media. We need to do a better job about digital literacy and civic education. But those are long-term prospects. I mean, I think the reality is, look, I'm an American and we tend to be a little bit individualist. And I would say, frankly, I think citizens also have to take more responsibility for how they consume information, how they sort of responsibly use platforms. I think sometimes our tendency can be to just blame those who are providing the goods. And certainly, you know, with increasing research about the addictive nature of some of the online information platforms, I do think that's a concern. But I also think that we as individuals also have to be responsible for how we engage in this. Yes, there is no doubt that certain of the social media platforms certainly provide an easy venue for discussion to rapidly degrade into argument and anger. But I also think that we need to, you know, all take responsibility for the fact that we need to be able to have much more constructive conversation, even if it's in the online space.
And this is a fascinating point about the way that national security is evolving, because previously, as citizens, we could very much kind of give up national security as something that the rough men on the borders prepared to do justice on our behalf could kind of take responsibility for. But now in this digital interconnected world where all of us have a social media and an internet connection, in many respects, we as the citizen are on the front line of a lot of these national security questions. But
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
What I did want to bring you to as well, you kind of mentioned a national security trigger word before, the kind of 5G elephant in the room. We know that this is part of a broader context of what some are calling a technology war between China and the US, and that there are a lot of questions over kind of future emerging technologies, who has control of them, what the risks are, how we kind of look after our national interests in a world that has a great deal of interconnectedness at the technological and economic level. So I wondered if you could give us some reflections on, you know, what is behind the US push on 5G and on limiting certain Chinese companies like Huawei and ZTE's participation in this market. Is it about economics or is it about security?
I think it's absolutely about security. And I would, of course, note that Australia has been a real leader on this issue. And so I think that's commendable. Look, I think it's about a couple of different things. One is there's very clear evidence about the relationship between Huawei, ZTE, and the Chinese government, in particular the security services, as well as, of course, the party. And those relationships are of concern. Number one, of course, in terms of enabling access to information, potential inclusion of backdoors and all of that. But on top of that, you also have a legal framework, understanding that in the PRC context, there's the legal framework and then there's the legal framework. I think the reality is that, you know, you also have laws that pretty clearly require companies to hand over data if and when requested. And so you combine the legal framework broadly in the PRC with the nature of the relationship between Huawei, ZTE, and the institutions of the state and the party. And then, you know, on top of that is simply the nature of 5G technology. This isn't just the next iteration of network connectivity. This is the next transformative aspect of our wired world. And it is not just about the 5G network and capabilities itself, but it is everything that will be layered on top of it after that and the standards that will be set by it. And the standards that will be set by it will have significant implications for not just follow-on technologies, but for the rules that come along with it. And that potentially has significant implications for a whole raft of technological developments to come, as well as, frankly, dependency relationships, right? So if you have countries who decide to get their 5G technology from Huawei, the long-term dependence that will be created by basically ensuring that all follow-on interoperable platforms that operate on that system need to come from China or Chinese companies also creates a long-term dependency, which creates the potential for a coercive relationship, which, of course, as we have seen very clearly through the PRC's activity, certainly in this region, but also more globally, coercion is something that they are pretty willing to engage in. So I think it's that combination of all of those pieces together, as if that wasn't enough reasons. I think that's a good sum up of at least some of the big ways that I think about it. But I think it is really important to understand that this is really not about economics. I mean, you know, the bottom line, frankly, is that there isn't an American company that can provide these capabilities right now. It's actually European companies that are the others who are competitive in this space at the moment. So on that pretty, you know, just straight up fact, it's pretty clear that this isn't about ensuring that an American company can win out.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that America isn't necessarily competitive in this space because there's a few frontier tech areas, kind of artificial intelligence, quantum, biotech, where there are real open questions about the ability of kind of America to remain number one in a lot of these emerging technologies. And I know America has a checkered history with the idea of industrial policy, you know, kind of trying to make homegrown industries more competitive. But in a world where we see technology and security seemingly converging more than it ever has in the past, is there more of a role for government to play in supporting certain key strategic industries? And indeed, how do we, when everything seems to be dual use, how do we even identify what those strategic industries are?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely a need for more government engagement in supporting the development of these technologies. I think one of the challenges that we see right now, certainly in the United States, is that a lot of the focus on these strategic industries or technologies, understandably, sort of for historical reasons, comes from our Department of Defense. But that, I think, number one, doesn't really reflect what these technologies are and what their applications are, and frankly, the direction we want to be guiding them in the development of, right? And two, if we go back to that, you know, somewhat tricky relationship between Silicon Valley and the U.S. government, it's you know, a relationship built primarily through DoD may not be the most effective one. You know, we contrast that with, for instance, Beijing, which has really marshaled under Xi Jinping a whole-of-nation approach to particularly AI, but also other emerging technologies, bringing not only the resources of the state but some strategic guidance around the direction it should go. You know, I do think that there are certain elements. You know, obviously, I'm a big believer in market forces and in the power of creativity in a competitive market to enable the best kind of technological development. But with some of these technologies, the importance of scale, the importance of access to very large data sets, the importance of being able to engage in learning in pretty robust and broad-based ways may actually speak to some advantages of at least having some greater both overarching sort of guidance, broader and longer term funding support, but also the ability to share certain elements of not only the research, but also training data and things like that. I think all of that speaks to why having some kind of, you know, national policy or national direction on the development of these technologies is going to be necessary if we want to be, number one, competitive. But I also think that competition isn't always just the right frame here, because it's not just about winning the race to build the best AI. It's about what does that AI look like? And is it an AI that's built in an authoritarian mold, or is it an AI that's built in a democratic mold, right? This goes back to the, you know, these technologies are essentially neutral. But on the AI front in particular, there's a couple of really different directions in which these technologies could grow and develop. And I think that it is in our interest very decidedly to ensure that these do so in a way that is not just consistent with, but is supportive of democracy.
So what you're saying is it's a good idea to have a strategy.
I think strategies are always a good thing. As a strategist, I'm certainly a fan of those.
Look, you've mentioned, well, we've been mentioning a bit kind of the idea of US-China competition, if you want to use that word, or certainly a step change in the US's approach to China. And I guess we mentioned one elephant in the room before. I want to mention another, which is kind of Donald Trump, right? Because I think a lot of people might associate the US's change in approach to China to a Trumpian kind of more muscular foreign policy approach and the kind of the Trump trade war. Other people, of course, say there is some type of new emerging Washington consensus that the US needs to change how it thinks about China and needs to think of it in terms of great power competition or in terms of being more of a risk or a threat. You're obviously from the Democrat side of politics in the US. Is there a new Washington consensus on China, and how bipartisan is this, and where is it likely to take us into the future?
So I think there is a sort of new, newly emerged bipartisan consensus in Washington that we need, that the increased assertiveness we have seen from China, coupled with the technological developments, coupled with, you know, increased evidence of China's, you know, under Xi Jinping's in particular, willingness to break some really important rules and to attempt to remake them in a way that is fundamentally more advantageous to authoritarian regimes in particular.
I think there is a pretty broad recognition in the U.S. across the political spectrum that that necessitates a new strategy that is more muscular, that is very focused on what our interests are, but also very much recognizing that our values and interests are fundamentally intertwined in this equation. What I would say, though, is my own view is that the Trump administration's approach is not a strategy. That parts of what the Trump administration is doing, I think, actually undermine our ability to have a smarter, tougher, more strategic approach to China. And in fact, that, you know, in many cases, there are elements of what the administration is doing that I think are quite problematic and in my mind don't actually constitute the kind of approach I'd like to see. But so what I think that means is there's broad consensus on the diagnosis. I don't think there's consensus on what the response should be in every form. What I would say, though, is I do continue to believe on this issue and on other national security issues that Trump remains largely an outlier. So even within the Republican Party, I think there's a lot more consensus with Democrats than there is with Trump. And I think that's true on this issue. So I do think that there is potential for even greater bipartisan consensus on what to do about China, but that may not necessarily reflect in any way what the Trump administration is doing.
Well, if we take this down to an Indo-Pacific kind of level and back to Australia, I mean, how sustained do you think the US's commitment to the Indo-Pacific and our region is likely to be given these new developments?
I think that the U.S. commitment to the Indo-Pacific region and to Australia specifically is quite enduring, and even in a Trumpian worldview, I don't see there being any pullback either from this region or from Australia specifically. I think that for a whole host of reasons, that will be an enduring commitment. And look, I will give the administration credit where it's due. I think the Indo-Pacific strategy that it's been talking about and deploying is the right thing. I think that the Build Act is a very positive step, and of course some of the other elements that come along with that. But as with any of these challenges, I think implementation will matter a lot. Showing up on a lot of these fronts matters. Anytime the U.S. is absent or leaves a vacuum, others seek to fill it. And what we don't want that to be is that for China to be the one filling that. I think the other thing that's really important is, of course, that in any successful strategy, whether dealing with China or whether dealing with the Indo-Pacific region more broadly, our allies really have to be the first element of that strategy and increasing the number of our partners. And I don't think that in engaging on any of these issues, we should be doing anything that actually undermines our allies and that undermines our ability to really continue to strengthen our relationships across the full breadth of it. And of course, that's not just the security space. That's also very importantly in the economic space as well. So that's where I think, you know, we probably need to be doing a bit of a better job. I would certainly urge this administration to do more that puts our allies first in any strategy. But I do have deep confidence in the abiding and enduring commitment of the United States to this region and to Australia.
Well, that's music, I'm sure, to many Australians' ears to hear that view from you. I guess as we round this out, I mean, we are in Australia, we're heading into a federal election at any time it could be called. And I know a lot of your work does focus, and we've touched on this already, on kind of the threat of foreign interference. And we know that, you know, that this particular threat isn't something that's static, it isn't definable, it's changing and it's evolving all of the time. So if you're looking ahead to, you know, the next kind of federal elections here in Australia or indeed out to 2020 in the US, what would you be thinking about as a smart strategist as kind of hotspots to watch in this evolution of foreign interference and in particular authoritarian foreign interference in democracies?
So I've spent a lot of time working on the sort of technologically enabled elements of this. And so, you know, I'm, of course, watching both how technology is evolving and then the adaptive nature of how, you know, particularly authoritarian regimes and their operations are employing them. So I think as we become better at detecting some of this activity, we see increasingly sophisticated ways that these nefarious actors are exploiting technologies. I think it's really important that we not look backwards, but that we continue to look in the present and future about how these technologies can be exploited. Certainly, as we look at how AI is going to enable new ways of interference operations, there's been a lot of conversations around something called deepfakes or synthetic media more broadly. But basically, this is it's AI created and enabled fake video and audio content that is undetectable to the human eye and ear. I think that is quite concerning, but I'm concerned about a whole host of other potential challenges, from the ability for mass data collection coupled with AI to even more robustly engage in emotional manipulation, to be able to do micro-targeting at greater scale. So those are all sort of my big concerns out there, in addition to a whole host of other big concerns that I have. But I think, you know, some of the most important things that we can be doing in the face of this is, number one, building resilience, raising awareness, you know, trying to set down very clear markers for our adversaries so that they know that this kind of activity is unacceptable and will be met with consequences, and that we need to be ensuring that we identify our vulnerabilities at home, that we do what we can to close those off, that we have whole of government strategies to make sure we have no seams, and again, to come back sort of where we started, that we really respond in a unified way. Many of these tactics are aimed at playing on our divisions, and the more we can respond in a unified way, the less effective any of these attacks are going to be.
Well, I think that's a kind of an optimistic way to end it, in the sense that we've got a relatively dim view of democracy, or democracy is going through some growing pains at the moment. But in some sense, what you're saying is democracy's strengths are actually what might pull us through this, the ability to marshal citizen power, to kind of have a decentralized grassroots approach to rebuilding some trust and to identifying and kind of countering foreign interference narratives. So the problem set is huge, but you know, the responses, it seems there is some light on the horizon for how we can go about addressing the challenges.
I certainly hope that's the case. It's what keeps me going every day.
Well, on that note, I feel like we could keep going on this for quite some time, but I do need to wrap up. But, you know, the conversation doesn't have to start and end in the podcast studio. You can get in touch with us by going to Twitter. We're at Apps Policy Forum. You can email us, podcast@policyforum.net. And you can also check us out on our Facebook group. That's all we have time for in the studio with Laura Rosenberger, but we will be back soon talking all things national security and Indo-Pacific on a phone or computer or anything that has audio and an internet connection near you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.